When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul.
How are you?
We are broadcasting from our nuclear bunkers today.
Yes. And I have to say, you look radiant. Yes, I know.
Facepalm.
I've used that joke before. But so today on the program, we'll be discussing Magnus Robot Fighter from Valiant Comics, issues 0-4, which covers the Steel Nation arc, written by Jim Shooter with art by Art Nichols. But first, let's talk about the complex legacy of one Mr. Jim Shooter.
Now, He's a tall man.
He is a tall man. Now, Jim Shooter has, how do you want to say it? He's a giant. He's a giant in the industry. He is rightfully given a lot of praise for the things he's done. And he's ruffled some feathers, let's say.
A couple here and there.
Yes. But first of all, I think one of the fascinating things about this guy is that he started writing comics at 14.
Yes. I mean, that's...
And not just, you know, writing little things. He was writing for Superman and Legion of Superheroes and Supergirl and, you know, like...
He was working with Kurt Swan.
Yeah. He was writing for tentpole,
issues. And he was 14.
And he did. I mean, it's not like, and it wasn't like he was just throwing stuff off. He co-scripted the Superman Flash race.
Right. Well, I mean, he was the first.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, exactly.
To write like the actual Superman Flash race.
Yeah. So he's no slouch at all. At 14.
I mean, every comic book fan's wet dream, right?
Right. Exactly.
You know, writing for comics at, yeah. So
yeah, and the story I heard was that he was he had some kind of injury. I don't know the exact injury, but he was convalescing in a hotel in a hospital, and just had a pile of comics and started reading them and said, "Oh, I could do this," and then he did. So that right there is pretty damned impressive.
Right.
He later went on to do some editing and then eventually moved to Marvel, where he wrote some. But he was more prominent as an editor and then later becoming editor in chief. And this was a time in the mid late 70s where Marvel was in a bit of a disarray. They were going through editors in chief, I should say, pretty quickly. There was like five editors in chief at the time. Lots of them were big names, right?
Like Archie Goodman.
There's Archie Goodman. There was Len Wein. They're not slouches, Marv Wolfman, but they were just, it was a grind. And there was deadlines being missed, and there were, you know, it was just sort of kind of crazy. If you look at Marvel at that time, it was sort of a free-for-all. And Jim Shooter came in and basically righted the ship. He was very strict and a strict disciplinarian by all accounts. And he sort of got them back on. He got people hitting deadlines, and if they couldn't hit the deadlines, he would have someone step in and take over for them. And he got Marvel to be back on track and made Marvel profitable.
Right. His methods were not beloved.
No.
His results for a good while.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he made Marvel profitable. For good or ill, he started the whole crossover trend.
Right.
Yeah.
He gave us limited series,
Secret Wars. He ended up getting a letter from someone who said Spider-Man should have a black costume, which he bought for $250. He bought that idea. And I think that had legs. That was probably a good investment.
For good or ill.
Yeah, that was probably a good investment on Marvel's part. But so as far as having a head for business, let's say, Jim Shooter, you can't deny the man had got results. However, on the downside, he was known to be a fairly abrasive human being.
A bit.
A little bit. A lot of creators from Marvel at the time We're driven away by him. And that's, you know, Marv Wolfman, Steve Gerber, John Byrne, and many others just could not deal with him and left. Now, there's a lot of stories going around and a lot of rumors and innuendo. And, you know, it's hard to piece through what really happened and what's just people being vicious.
Right.
You know, personalities clashing. What did happen, however, was there was a party, I believe at John Byrne's house, where they burned Jim Shooter in effigy. And there's video of this. So yeah, if you've annoyed people enough that they would burn you in effigy, like I said, probably a little abrasive.
Or you're doing the right thing.
I don't know. I mean, there's other things about him that as an editor, he he didn't allow gay characters to be introduced. Right. There's one Hulk issue where Bruce Banner is attacked and assaulted by gay men in a shower. And it's like, yeah, that was all him.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, DC wasn't, comics wasn't.
No, but at the same time, but there were people.
About the progressivism, the alleged progressivism of, you know, Stan Lee and things like that. But but
there were people like Chris Claremont who were trying to, at least trying to introduce new characters and push comics in a different way. And people like, and someone like Jim Shooter was actively working against that.
Sure.
Yeah.
But Chris Claremont was also the cash cow.
But then, you know, I mean, Shooter's also the guy behind the Avengers, Carol Danvers, you know, controversy where Carol Danvers is mind controlled and impregnated and then sent away with her abuser. It's a complicated legacy, let's say. On one hand, Jim Shooter is obviously an incredibly creative person who has a great mind for business. I mean, that cannot be denied. On the other hand, he really put people off and worked against moving comics forward in favor of doing what is profitable in the now rather than looking towards the future.
Sure. But he was also tasked with having to do this. And this is not a Jim Shooter defense. What he did well, he did better than maybe any other editor-in-chief has done.
Right, but it's not just...
What he did badly...
He did better than anybody else.
He did better than... Yeah. Has had repercussions as well. And I think you kind of nailed it with your for the now rather than the future.
And it's not just Marvel, because he started Valiant and made it profitable and then was fired. And then he started Broadway Comics and was fired. And then started Defiant Comics and was fired. So it's almost, now it's speculation, but it's... If he was more of a people person, I think he would be better regarded. You know, his stricter ideas about business would have gone over easier. And again, just speculation, but the fact that he was so strict and he was so abrasive, his hardline tactics were not, they just didn't go over well.
You know? No,
it's easier to take criticism when someone's nice about it.
Yeah. I mean, but at the same time, he also was in situations where, you know, what's the inmates running the asylum. You can't have the inmates running the asylum necessarily. So
I
don't want to come across as defending Jim Shooter in some ways because he was horrible. And again, you brought up just even the social issues and the various things that he was adamantly opposed to and set Marvel back. It brought them forward, but yes, set them back in some ways to a situation where, you know, DC was able to kind of move forward in some of these things. It's why we got Watchmen, why we got Swamp Thing, why we got Hellblazer, why we got Dark Knight, why we got some of these very interesting things happening at DC, because creators didn't want to touch Marvel with a 10-foot pole, because, you know, DC was able to, it's why all the great British writers were coming over from 2000 AD and other places, right. Grant Morrison's and whatnot, who were like, well, DC's going to let us do things that Jim Shooter sure as hell ain't going to let us do.
Right. Yeah. So he made money, but at the expense of progressive creativity, I guess.
Right. So when you see like what we would call evergreen titles coming out of the 80s, it's not coming from Marvel.
No.
Marvel made the big money. They made the big splashes. They had the big events. They had, you know, Jim Shooter was brilliant about, you know, I mean, for a time, I think even Secret Wars was being held up as a greater piece of work than Crisis. History has proven differently.
Well, yeah. I mean, to his credit, he did beat Crisis as far as having the big crossover event. But he was more focused on toy sales rather than quality of the story.
Right. But when you have a failing business, sometimes things have to change.
It's true. But I'm so torn with this because when I love Marvel in the 70s, I love Marvel in the 70s. They were doing such radically insane things with Gerber and Wolfman and Len Wein and so many people, but they were insane. They were just sort of willy-nilly throwing things off and missing deadlines. And yeah, it was the inmates running the asylum for a while.
Right.
I loved what came out of it, but that you can't run a business that way. So right. I'm really torn with Jim Shooter. I mean, there is no doubt that, like I said, he's a creative man who knows the business side of things, and he should be rightfully lauded for those aspects. But there's his downsides. He stifled creativity. He drove off. When you have, they had a cadre of talent at Marvel that went over to DC and did great stuff for them.
Yeah. But interestingly enough, a lot of that stuff didn't translate fiscally. Some of it did. Some of those things were like huge smash hits.
But again, long run, DC dominated in the 90s because of that. Because they were able to pull in that talent. Because they were able to do really unique and interesting titles.
Right. Whereas, I don't know dollar-wise we'd have to research that. But certainly in the stuff that we remember. But at the same time, Jim Shooter was such a massive presence in my life. Again, I was born in 1972. So the 80s were, in many ways, I mean, we are literally kind of smack dab in the Gen X realm, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, like even though I was born in the 70s, I was a kid. The most influential decade in my life was the 80s, right? In terms of my growth. And obviously, it's got the hell out of high school and experienced college, things like that. My mindset changed and different things changed. But the really strong formative years of my life when I'm understanding creativity and I'm reading comics first as just a fan that likes the Biff Bam Pow. And then as I go through that decade and, you know, my ideas change and things like that, there is absolutely no way that Jim Shooter did not influence my life as a comic book fan. Is he a terrible human being? We could go into more spurious.
I don't want to do that.
Proven, yeah. Some of them are not. But at the end of the day, it's like he like landmarked himself in that decade in a way that very few people did. How he did it is kind of ugh.
Right.
But I didn't know that in the 80s.
No, I didn't. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I'm very much torn on Jim Shooter I've never met the man, so I can't say.
Same, yeah.
Yeah, but all I know are the stories about him. And it's pretty obvious that many companies decided to get rid of him with prejudice. So,
well, yes, over and over, and I mean, even returned to DC a few years, a few years ago, when he came back to DC, right, to write Legion again.
Right. You know, and he's still doing stuff. I mean, he's still around.
And so, you know, his his reputation preceded him enough that even DC was like willing to bring him back. But, you know, he had kind of seminal runs on Legion. So,
yeah,
you know, of course, he didn't last very long, even in his return to writing for DC. But it's hard. It's I can't deny his influence on my youth. And, you know, when I get older and I start hearing about all of the other things, it sours things, but I can't completely separate him. Like I threw out Fumetti recently, but
yeah,
you know, I mean, come on, those whole like back page stuff where it was, you know, the Fumetti black and white photos and Jim Shooter was always involved with stuff. And you read that and you looked at it and it's like, man, the Marvel bullpen must be a really fun place to hang out. Meanwhile, everybody in those photos are probably in their minds going, you know, fuck this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, sorry. You might have to beat that.
No big deal. Yeah, I just, no, he's good. I mean, we didn't even mention it. He was the mastermind behind Epic.
Right.
You know, and so, I mean, so yeah, his impact on comics, not just Marvel, but just comics in general, is immense.
Yeah.
But it's difficult. It's difficult to like the man.
Right. It has many positives, has many negatives. You know, wading through that sometimes becomes depressing. And it's like, I just want to read some West Coast Avengers.
I know. So this is actually two episodes in a row where we're dealing with Jim Shooter. Yeah. Because
he also gave us Beauty and the Beast, a crime that
and Dazzler in general. Yeah, well, Dazzler, that was the first comic to be sold directly to exclusive to comic shops, you know.
Right.
So I mean, he was very influential in starting up the direct market, or I guess
for good or for ill,
for pushing it. Yeah, again. And short term, it made Marvel a lot of money. And that was what his job was.
At the end of the day, that kind of is.
Yeah. So
we don't have to like it. And we have other socioeconomic ideas about these things too. But
yeah.
But Marvel, I don't believe Marvel. Well, I don't know. I mean, this is whataboutism and speculation. Would Marvel exist now if it weren't for Jim Shooter?
Well, I guess I do think it would exist, but it would exist in a very different way. It's Jim Shooter, boy, what a complicated guy.
Complicated guy. He gave rise to the Jim Quesadas and the Joe Quesadas and the Tom Bravuts of the world too, which I believe is also a crime.
I'm not as harsh on them as you are, but that's for another day. Let's take a break, and when we come back, let's talk about more Jim Shooter.
Woo!
The Swamp, more than merely a place. It is a churning, seething, bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a chemist named Ted Salas, until one little experiment went somewhat awry, and you changed. The serum that was to have made you a super soldier combined with the strange forces in the swamp to make you over into this, a shambling, mindless mockery of your former humanity. The macabre Man-Thing.
Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you too can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre.
And we're back. Paul, you have recommended a fascinating comic for today's discussion, and it is Magnus Robot Fighter. Would you like to tell us a little bit about this very interesting comic book?
I will indeed. In In 1991, a brand new comics publisher, Valiant, launched its debut title, Magnus Robot Fighter, written by the company's co-founder, Jim Shooter. Magnus was a character originally created for Gold Key Comics back in the 60s, and the new series for Valiant would be a direct continuation of that continuity while at the same time being a soft reboot, or it's known by many in the industry, a recontin continuboot. The story is set in the year 4001, where an elite class of humans live in the luxurious high-rise cities of North Am, served by armies of servant robots catering to their every need and whim. But due to a quirk of fate, a large portion of the robot population obtain free will and decide to rebel against their human oppressors. In comes Magnus Robot Fighter, who is a man named Magnus that fights robots in a miniskirt, which, to be fair, was the style at the time. Magnus was raised from early childhood by a free-willed robot and trained to peak physical strength, so much so that he can fight robots barehanded, willing his hands to be as hard as steel. Lauded as a hero and a savior, Magnus becomes a celebrity, complete with fame, fortune, and a debutante girlfriend that just happens to be the daughter of a prominent senator. All seems to be going well. But things get complicated when Magnus discovers that the free-willed robots are actually thinking, feeling beings with a desire to survive and live. And his simple mission of fighting robots becomes harder to justify when he realizes that the things he's killing aren't mindless machines, but sentient. Magnus Robot Fighter is a surprisingly deeper and more complex comic than it has any right to be, as well as a surprising comic to launch a publishing line and an eventual shared universe on. It deals with philosophical ideas like what it means to be alive, what does it mean to be free? And it deals with politics, poverty, and it even touches on gender identity in a small way. And all this coming from Jim Shooter, who was not known for being sensitive in those areas. It's also able to convey both a modern and retro atmosphere, especially in the art by Art Nichols, who's able to give this a very 90s style, while at the same time, he's able to invoke a very 60s look and feel. So when all is said and done, for something that should be ridiculous, Magnus Robot Fighter is able to pull off something remarkable. A well-told, layered story with complex ideas and themes about a guy in a miniskirt who fights robots. A valiant effort indeed. Brian, what did you think of Magnus Robot Fighter?
Well, Paul, I enjoyed the hell out of this comic.
It's surprisingly good, isn't it?
It's surprisingly good. And we had talked, letting other folks kind of know the, backroom stuff. But, we were coming off Beauty and the Beast. And you were like, I'm going to recommend something else goofy. Because we had done some pretty heavy stuff.
Right.
In previous podcasts. And so I was approaching this as, oh, this is going to be, another goofy thing. And there are clunky aspects to this comic, absolutely. But I really enjoyed this.
I know. This is my second time reading it through. I had read it a couple of years ago and was kind of impressed by it. But it was one of those things where I just sort of like, oh, that was interesting. And I went and I forgot about it. And then I was like, oh, I remember. I just remembered it as being the guy in the miniskirt who fights robots. Won't this be fun to talk about? But yeah. Reading it through this second time, I was like, wow, there's some ideas here that a bit deeper than I had anticipated.
It's really intriguing, and I have to say, so I looked up Art Nichols. I couldn't find a whole lot.
No, I couldn't either.
There's no, wiki page that I could find. But one of the things that struck me about the art is it's very 2000 AD.
Right.
Yeah. And the themes of this comic are very aligned with like 2000 AD.
Yes, you're right.
In some ways. And yeah. There's like a David Lloyd sort of representation that Nichols is doing. I don't want to say who came first or who, but I really liked, it's the paneling is very interesting because it's very you know, 2, 4, 6 with occasionally some larger splashes, but it's not trying to be, you know, this isn't J.H. Williams.
No, it's very much trying to emulate those old Gold Key comics, you know, and I think that's where a lot of the clunkiness you were talking about from the story as well, because they're trying to do a direct continuation off of that. So they're still keeping, you know, the chauvinism and the, you know, there's some sexism in there in the beginning, but they're also trying to make it, trying to subvert that a little bit as well.
Right. And I just think, and again, to Art Nichols, it's some of these splash panels and the attention to detail that he does with the robots is pretty fantastic.
Yes, absolutely. And especially, you know, as it goes along and they start wearing clothes, you know, it's very, it's not pointed out. It's just sort of
affectation.
Like,
it's the subtle thing, but it's a great affect. We'll talk about that probably down the line, but
yeah, there's one, again, just to go a little bit ahead, we'll backtrack in a second here, but there's to give an example of that, they're in the underground of Magnus and Legia are in the underground of the city, and there's a cop there who runs off in fear. Magnus says, "Don't run off, it's dangerous out here." And it's without a word, another scene is going on, and you just see one of the goofs, one of the people from the underground, just putting on cop clothes.
Right.
He's putting on the cop's uniform. So, you know, something bad happened to that guy. You know, and it's just a panel of this guy putting it on. And then, you know, Magnus is having a completely different scene going on.
So it's, but, like the, it's like a half panel.
Right. Exactly.
Because something else is going on the other half of the panel that you're actually supposed to be paying attention to. And meanwhile, in this alley, you just see this, you know, homeless, well, they're not homeless, but, you know, guy just putting on the clothes that are clearly the
cop,
runaway, the runaway cop's clothes.
Right. But anyway, there's stuff like that just peppered throughout all these issues, you know, just little, like you said, attention to detail. There's so many little things, like every time a robot dies, he says, "Squee."
I know there's a lot of squeeing. Is this a precursor to Squee?
I guess. Well, yeah. Well, it's not a happy Squee, for sure.
No. It's not a happy Squee. there's a lot of dead robots in this comic.
Yes, but the thing, they make it's very conflicted, because you don't want the robots to die, but of course, Magnus is a robot fighter, so he has to fight robots.
Yes. Although he's conflicted.
Yes. Now, I have read on from this.
Mini skirt and all.
Yes. Again, I love that fact that they didn't try to redesign him, because that was his character look in the 60s. And they just, let's just go with the mini skirt. It's fine.
Now, I do have to say, we have to address the mini skirt, because we have to address the fact that, you know, Supergirl and Wonder Woman and various other female characters are probably looking at this going, see how ridiculous this is? That man is wearing a miniskirt. You're going to talk about the fact that this man is fighting robots in a miniskirt. And I'm sure they're sitting there going, hey, you know, how come you didn't think it was ridiculous when we have to do it?
Right.
They would be right.
But he does have a lot of, you know, freedom in his legs, and I'm sure there's a lot of ventilation going on.
Well, yeah. We come close to upskirt stuff there.
Come close, but not quite.
Right.
So this is Art Nichols is, you know, it's definitely a 90s comic from some of the way the females are posed, and it's very 90s, but it still has that 60s pulp sci-fi feel to it at the same time. It's a very fine line to walk, but I think Nichols does quite a good job of it.
I didn't mean to pull us away from the story itself.
No.
I think Nichols does just such a great job. And this isn't, you know, the art that we're used to now. You know, this is still four color art in some ways, but he really conveys good emotion, good action. I just was really impressed with Nichols' work on this.
Yeah, me too. And I love that retro futurist look to it as well. You know, it's almost, you know, very Jetsons in its feel, especially some of the cityscapes.
Everything's up in the clouds, right?
Yeah, so that's kind of the you know, so there's a stratification of society. So,
right.
You know, the rich are obviously living in the cities high in the sky, whereas on the ground floor, if you want to call it that, that's where all the poor people are, right, the goofs.
Goof. So you're saying goof. I was mixed between whether it was goff or goof.
I was thinking more of like gopher because they're down below.
Right.
I could be wrong about that. It's the same thing. Like they called, for short, the robots are called Robs. I assume it's pronounced Robs or I assume it's spelled Robes, like robot Robes. That's what I thought.
Yeah. I kept saying, like in my mind, I was like, oh, Rob this, Rob that.
Yeah, me too, actually. I kept reading it as Rob, and I kept picturing like Mary Tyler Moore going, oh, Rob.
Oh, Rob. Yeah, David was right there.
Yeah.
But that's interesting too, right? I mean, it's so, you know, we talk a lot about various sci-fi shows that world build, and we say world build a lot. And
yes.
But that's a real thing. But, you know, everything, like the use of language, where it's like, you know, it's everything is rob or robe this, rob or robe that. And, you know, then malfunct. It's not a malfunction, it's a malfunct.
Right.
And there's a whole language that Shooter is doing here. That's really interesting. And he's consistent. He is consistent across the board. It's like almost like he thought about it.
Yeah, almost. I did write down an example of a slang sentence. It was one of the captains, as she is about to fight robots. She says, any pot skulls show their knobs. We'll toast them before you can say griggy diggy. And it sounds, I know it sounds ridiculous, but I just loved that. It's like, well, yeah, sure. It
works on the page. This is a fantasy. This is a dude fighting robots in the year 4001. You know, so.
Yeah. And you know, people are going to have like little derogatory slang terms for the robots. So pot skulls.
And yeah.
Get and your knobs out of here. Yeah.
Right. And probably my favorite character in the whole series, Elsie, which we'll get to.
Yes.
Has the best lines.
Oh, yeah. She's amazing.
I mean, this is, I don't want to say it's Burgess's Clockwork Orange level of language manipulation, but
not quite there.
but it's great. I love how she speaks. And again, this is a character that comes in much later, but it's I want to say it's good writing. I hate to say that Jim Shooter is doing good writing.
You know what?
I have to acknowledge that he's doing good writing.
He is doing good writing, and he is a creative. He's a creative writer. I mean, he knows how to write a comic. Whatever you think, you know what we talked about before. But whatever you think of Jim Shooter, he knows how to write a comic. I was stunned at the things he's writing about in this.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll get to Tikla soon enough, but
I do want to say off the bat, like when we're talking about the comic and especially the beginnings, I'm not a numbers person. I'm a word person. So I'm going to mess up some of the robots names.
I think all we need to really worry about, there's OX1, Oxy.
Oiks.
There you go. But OX1, who is sort of the rebel leader or the revolutionary. And then there's W23, not WD40. W23, who's a restaurant or a waiter robe.
Or a waitress.
We'll get to that.
We'll get to that.
I'm really interested to see what your take on that is. But let's start. So this is a five issues if you count issue zero. It is the 90s. We got to have zeros.
We still have zeros.
I know we still have zeros. Not as much. That's not as prevalent as it once was.
Marvel just gets to 8 and then starts at 1. Oh, no. Did I fit that in there? I did.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Okay. So we begin with a kind of, you know, an episode, a typical issue zero, where we get the previous continuity. What is, you know, we learn about who Magnus is and what his backstory is. He was raised as a foundling by a robot who has free will, but a robot who hates robots, apparently.
Yeah.
1A is his sort of mother, father creature. So this...
There are words in other communities for what 1A is.
Yeah. He's a self-hater. But he raises Magnus to fight robots, to kill robots, and raises him to peak physical performance, which apparently anyone can do, but we're just too lazy to do it.
Yes. Well, I love the karate chop, right? I mean, it's like Magnus, he's got the fist of steel, which isn't made of steel. It's just a regular fist, but he's been trained. So, and you see this in action throughout. There's a lot of great action sequences.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of great action sequences. Again, credit to the artist. You know, it's karate chop.
Lots of karate chops, lots of punching. But 1A uses what he calls the perfect method. I think he's a bit full of himself, mm-hmm. calling his. But maybe it's the perfect, like perfect yourself. Now that I say it out loud, I don't know.
But he's also a prefect.
There you go.
So anyway, carry on.
Magnus he's trained to peak physical performance and set off to kill robots. And 1A just keeps reminding him that these are mindless creatures. They're just machines. Do not feel bad about it. And that's how we start the story.
Well, we should also mention there's something weirdly specific. Shooter does this weirdly. He's very weirdly specific about numbers throughout this whole thing. You probably caught that. You know, well, there were 963,421, and now we're at 9,360. There's a lot of numbers here, but we should point out, right, that North Am is North America.
North America, exactly.
Right, and the entire continent has now been, it's a city, which again it has that 2000 AD thing going for it.
Yeah, it's like Mega City 1.
So I love the fact that they very specifically are, and you'll pardon me for geekiness here, I apologize. The population in North Am is 139,513,641 and 171 human beings. Yes, I'm reading that because I couldn't remember that number.
It's very specific, yes.
It's very specific. And the robot population is 32,472,441.009. I'm sorry, but I had to get that in there.
And I don't know if these are significant or if he was just randomly pulling these numbers out of nowhere. But
he's just there's constant references to numbers and, you know, Magnus killed 12. So now we're down to X amount.
Oh, he was keeping a tally for sure.
Yeah, they were keeping a tally.
Very impressive. There's actually, because every robot has a number associated with them. Yes. And there was two that kept popping up, PS4 and PS5. Mm. And I goes, oh, they must be the gamer robots. And those two robots are out of stock all the time.
We would also be remiss. I gotta, again, I keep distracting us, but there is also a BB-8.
Yes, there is a BB-8. I did make a note of that.
Yeah. There is a BB-8 later on in the comic.
I'm sure that's just a coincidence. We never can tell with what's his name, J.J. Abrams. Maybe maybe he's a Magnus fan. Who knows? So what happens in the story? It's a very simple story with complicated ideas around it. The story is basically that some of the robots, for some reason we don't know what, they achieve consciousness and they become sentient. What's that?
We do find out how they... Am I getting ahead of things?
Well, yeah. I mean, but it's very technobabbly.
Right.
You know, even though we do find out why it happens, but it's still, to me, I think it's just sort of hand-wavium. The hand-wavium was struck by lightning and everyone got consciousness. All we need to know is that some of the robots become sentient and they decide, and it's fascinating, I think, that some of them become conscious, but they're afraid to let anyone know. So they're hiding in the closet, as it were, not, you know, afraid to let anyone know that they're different until this one robot, OX1 or Oxy, Oiks decides that he's going to, I want to say he wants to lead a rebellion, but it's not quite there yet. What he wants to do is talk to a senator to try to get freedom for his people.
Right. Like
he doesn't want to start a war, but because the politicians are unwilling to give rights to these robots, then a war has to start. We're getting into some really complicated ideas here.
Right. Well, we also have politics going on where the current president is like, well, let's just give it to them and avoid this forthcoming war.
Yeah, but that won't play well with the population. Yeah, so we can't, we can't look weak. We can't negotiate with robots. That's insane. Right. And then you have, of course, Magnus, who is seen as the devil to robots. He is, he's the executioner of robots. They're trying, several assassination attempts are made against Magnus. And then this scene actually reminded me a lot of, Metropolis, Fritz Lang movie.
Right.
Where there's a big rebellion in the underground. They have this charismatic leader who's trying to tell everyone to fight for their freedom and unify. So this big meeting is going on underground, and Magnus and Legia, his girlfriend.
Who is also the daughter of the senator. Who is the scheming senator.
Who's, he's very fleshy, very, very flabby kind of guy, very typical bad guy senator. Legia, by the way, let's just a complete aside, you don't really see it in this arc. I mean, she's just a damsel in distress, ditzy, helpless female in this storyline. Her character grows. I've read on in this, and her character becomes a much stronger presence in the story.
Well, we see that coming in some of the very last pages of the final issue.
Exactly. Yeah, so she becomes more of a Legia princess warrior. But she kind of tags along with her man. That's how she's portrayed. Magnus comes to understand that these robots aren't evil killing machines, or they're thinking, feeling beings, and they want to live. And he becomes very conflicted as to what to do.
What's the question of what is life?
Baby, don't hurt me.
Doing a techno beat playing.
So Magnus actually tries to. He wants to know. He jumps down into the middle of this meeting of robots, and he really wants to understand. Who are you? Let me learn from you. But of course, the upstart military man comes crashing in and disrupts the entire meeting.
Right, and this is Timbuk. I don't know if it's 1, 2, or 3.
But they always say we need to have all of our generals and Timbuk too. So Timbuk, he's the stereotypical
mustache, Errol Flynn.
Yeah, but he's the rash guy who just plows in without thinking. So all of this, all the violence that's going to come up soon in this storyline could be avoided, but for the ignorance of man.
Right. Well, and Oiks is also has made several overtures looking for peace.
Exactly.
Because he also, they're not, we can get in the gendered nature of the robots later, but, Oik shows up and they try to talk to Senator Klain, who is the evil senator who is the father of Legia.
Right.
And, there's a huge conversation about, why would you sacrifice? Oiks talks about we as robots cannot reproduce. You can reproduce. And they were like, what is the level that you would sacrifice your people? You know, how much death is too much death, or how much death are you willing to allow? And, you know, Plain, of course, is the stereotypical, you know, evil politician who's like, this is a really weird conversation we're having based on current events. But,
yes.
You know, a timely recommendation, Paul.
Yeah, coincidental, but hey, it works.
Right. And Klain is, the Senator Klain is like, I don't care. You're evil because you're not human. You do not have the same emotions or whatever that I have. So, and this happens numerous times. Oix tries, I'm sorry, I keep calling him Oix.
That's all right. Please do. He's Oix. Oix
tries numerous times to find a peaceful solution and is rebuffed constantly.
And becomes radicalized.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interesting thing. So at the breakup of this, when Tim Buck comes crashing through and breaks up this meeting, and the robots actually attack Legia and injure her quite badly. And then later when she's in the hospital, the senator is very, very upset. Senator Klain is very upset until his press person says, you know, this could play really well with the people. You having your daughter injured, you know, you could really, your popularity could go up quite a bit. And he thinks about it for a second, like, oh yeah, that's a good point. And it's just so cynical, but at the same time, that's kind of what would happen.
Right.
So let's move on. So now we have basically a war is going to be started. Again, I want to touch on this before we get into the actual fighting. So one of the robots is injured. There's a very interesting repair scene where the other robots are trying to repair this, this robot, this injured robot. But in order to do so, they take away his free will. So they repair the robot, but they fix something in his brain, or fix or break something in his brain to take away his free will.
Right. Yeah. So because the robots are trying to figure out, not all robots have, the vast majority of robots do not have free will, right? Because
hashtag not all robots.
Not all. Yeah. Thank you, Mark Russell. surprise, we haven't mentioned that yet. Right. So what happened was there's a tech robot had a weird twitch that in the mind brain or whatever it was called, right? So the reason some robots, and it is a vast minority of robots, got free will was because of a weird glitch. The weird glitch did something in their robot minds, which changed how their circuits worked. And that's what gave them what we consider free will, whereas the vast majority of robots did not get this. What happens, right, this is what you're referring to, is that when they try to repair these, they can't figure out how to repair them without the free will going away.
Exactly.
And it's devastating. The scene you're talking about is devastating.
It is. And, you know, and then you have several times after that, you have some robots saying, don't repair me. I'd rather die than to lose my free will again.
Or self-aware.
Yeah, self-awareness. Yeah.
Free will thing, and we can or cannot touch on this. There's a libertarian strain in here that irritates me a little bit. So and, you know, free will versus self-awareness.
Or sentience, or, you know.
Right.
I took it as not just free will, but sentience of being self-aware, like you said. So self-determination. It can go in multiple different ways. Probably from what I know about Jim Shooter, you're probably right. It's more of a libertarian thing, but
right.
I choose to think of it as self-awareness. All that aside. So I guess the two strains of the story from here on in are Oix now wants to basically fight a war and overthrow humanity.
Mm-hmm.
That's his deal. Whereas Magnus now has doubts and wants to step back and says, you know, I can't fight this war because I can't let people die, but at the same time, I don't want to kill these sentient beings. So, and that therein lies the conflict. And then you have Legia, who now has been injured by the robots. So she has become very anti-robot. Can't understand why Magnus won't kill these things. It's all very, I wonder how this played back in 1991. Because I can draw comparisons to what's happening today. The only thing that's missing from this comic book is Facebook.
Yeah, it if you introduce social media into.
Yeah. Well, they do watch videos and hear things played. You know, you could consider that podcasts and YouTube. So, right.
Yeah. Podcasts being, let's be honest, the most important means of communication.
Oh, absolutely. Days. It's one of the most, influential means of communication in the last 100 years, as far as I'm concerned.
Possibly in the history of, cave paintings. Pfft.
We should probably do a podcast about that.
Yeah.
So anyway, what happens now? It also in the background is this, we don't see him again in this arc, but 1A, so Magnus's mother, father, robot.
Right.
And that's what he calls himself. I am your mother and father.
And 1A keeps goading Magnus, yes. Right?
And he keeps telling him, these are not real creatures. They're not worthy, if you want to say that. He keeps goading him to just kill them, just kill them. And Magnus is really, really conflicted by this.
Right. 1A is a former slave who has gained independence and yet uses their independence to encourage Magnus to suppress the other creatures / slaves / workers.
Yes.
One can draw their own conclusion there.
Again, I just am so curious as to, was Jim Shooter aware of what he was doing? Or was he just sort of flying on autopilot? I don't know. How intentional was this story, Brian?
Well, I mean, I'm a deconstructionist, and you are not, so neither of us are reader response, so let's just tell the story, right?
I guess so. But there's just too many... Okay, let's just tell the story.
Parallels to other things.
Exactly. Exactly. I find it, I hope that Jim Shooter was being intentional with this storyline, that he knew what he was doing.
Don't get us wrong. At the end of the day, this is a big, dumb, action-packed and very action-packed about, robots and people fighting each other.
This is a man in a miniskirt who karate chopped robots. Yes. I mean, that's as ridiculous as it gets.
So don't get us wrong. At the end of the day, if you're just looking for dudes karate chopping robots and big action sequences, you are set.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and silly dialogue and so forth. But what I'm saying is there's a lot going on in this, subtextually. Not even subtextually. Anyway.
Some of it seems pretty overt.
Yeah. Okay. So Magnus kind of goes off. He now becomes an enemy of the state because he won't fight for the humans.
Well, he'll fight for the humans. He's just not going to...
kill for the humans.
Unilaterally, just he's having thoughts and feelings, and he's having a crisis of conscience. Like, he's fine, offing or killing Rogue. The robots are called Rogue, the free will... whatever we
yeah. call
them. Robots are called, rogues.
Or rogots.
Rogue, yes. He's fine killing them. He says, if they are going to hurt humanity, then I will fight and destroy them. Whether we want to call it killing or destroying, that's a situation that the comic doesn't really resolve. I think it may down the line, because I think it's set up to resolve that.
Yes.
But, he's fine taking out... We see this at a later point when it's all-out war.
Right. And
we're given to understand that he has probably destroyed hundreds of thousands of these things.
Yes. And one of the issues is actually called Soldier.
Right.
Where he's trying to reconcile his morality, basically, with the fact that he is a soldier and he is at wartime. So is it morally okay to kill because he's a soldier? Yeah, it's...
You will, however, not take out W-23, a.k.a. Tekla.
Yes. So, okay. Essentially, if we want to get into the storyline itself, to speed this along a little bit, you basically have Oikes augments himself a little bit and then heads for the main brain, which is where all the robots are controlled.
Right.
And in that case, he can not only communicate to the free-willed robots, but he also can control... just the standard service robots as well.
Yeah.
So they all become this great army that can basically take over all of North Am. And at this point, Magnus can't ignore this any longer. He has to become involved, and he fights his way to the main brain. The main brain. I think that's kind of fun.
The main brain.
So he fights his way there to, by the way, it's in Stark Robotics Research Lab.
That was a point of amusement for me as well.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So, you know, good for Shooter, because you know he put that in there, you know, intentionally. So he gets there, and a lot happens. Oh, some really great fight sequences happen. He has to fight this one hammer claw.
Right.
Yeah, this augmented robot that really, really hates Magnus. But anyway, there's a big old, just big old fight scenes, great action. And then what Magnus ends up doing is just not only stopping the robots, but he also destroys the main brain. So he, and am I wrong about this? He essentially frees even the service robots.
He frees the service. He frees all robots.
He frees all robots.
Now, those robots don't get free will or sentience, but they are no longer being controlled from a central government.
Mm-hmm. A deep state, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And then his final act of defiance is when Tim Buck tries to goad him into, you know, killing all the robots. He gets a good swipe at Tim Buck. And that's how it is. Well, we didn't mention really quickly that, you know, Magnus also has an implant in his brain that allows him to hear all the robots, their frequency, so he can hear what they're saying.
Right, which is kind of a big plot point, not necessary to the generic telling of the story, but it does give him an advantage over others, and it's a secret that he has, because 1A put this implant in his brain so he could hear the communications. Yes.
Yes, but it's a big deal because at the end, he goes to the underground and he has this implant removed from his brain. So it's sort of his act of, he frees himself as well from the influence of 1A. Yeah, so that's actually the story. And it's really a fascinating story about, here's someone who's a soldier meant to kill the enemy, but comes to identify with the enemy, or at least see their point of view.
Right.
And goes out of his way to try to help them.
And refuses to be, dare I say, brainwashed.
Yeah. So he actually de-radicalizes himself, if you want to say it that way.
Well, he de-radicalizes and re-radicalizes. Well, you read ahead, based on just the reading of his story. At the end of the day, he removes himself from the constraints of the society as it was, and the ideas that society had about the other.
He becomes more open-minded.
Sure.
Along the way, there is one of, probably to me, the most interesting, fascinating ideas in this story, is there is the waiter robot, WD-40, who is coded as male. There is no doubt. He's a waiter with a bow tie. He's coded as male.
Right. We, the reader, make an assumption on that.
I think I would have to go back and read it again, but I definitely think he is coded as being a male, being seen as him.
As much as one can gender a robot.
Exactly. Well, WD-40 then gets, how come I call him that? W-23, it gets a new chassis, you know, a new body, which is definitely female. He actually bases his look on Legia because he is in love, or confesses he wants to know what love is.
He is in love with
Magnus.
Or has developed feelings of interest, because D-23 has sentience.
Yes. So,
and so they develop an attachment.
Right. So W-23 gets a new body, which is definitely female, and they,
it's a sexy time robot.
Indeed. But they definitely regender themselves and come up, they have a new name, Tekla, and they identify differently. Now, am I reading too much into this? Because it's 1991 and it's Jim Shooter.
And well, and that's the thing, is it's Jim Shooter. So I think the tricky part, though, is that we see this, not to go too long into this, but we see once the robots have taken over, you know, once Oix takes over all the robots, one of the things that Oix does is encourage the robots to dress themselves and to acquire things that give them identity beyond.
Yes, they want to differentiate themselves from normal robots.
And tell each one apart. And so the robots then, and you see this in numerous panels during this time, is that they acquire commercial goods and use these things to give them identity. And so you see some of these robots are dressing themselves or adorning themselves with things that give them what we would consider gendered identities.
Right. Like one wears a cape and a top hat and one wears a dress. Yeah. So they are.
This is about sentience. This is about understanding their sort of place within the hierarchy or within the world or within the statutes of what we think is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could see it as simply individuality. They're each coming up with a new personality, which, you know, again, probably in 1991 with Jim Shooter, that's probably what they were going for. It was just individuality. But in 2022, it can be seen in a very different way.
Well, and this is where we bring in a different reading. And I understand some of our listeners might be like, you can't do that. And that's fair, except it happened.
Yes, it happened. And your reading isn't wrong. Even if, I mean, if you're seeing it through modern eyes, I mean, if that's what you're getting, if you're reading an old story and you get something that speaks to you today, that's not a wrong way of looking at media.
Right.
You know what I mean?
The generic author's intent can have subtleties that they don't even know that they're doing.
Exactly. And, you know, a good story will grow and take shape in the time that it's read in, not just in the time that it was written. So I find it really hard to say Jim Shooter was ahead of his time. Is that possible?
I mean, sure, why not?
Yeah, let's give him credit.
Because we don't know what he was trying.
Let's just give it, this is a good story.
Right. It opens up a ton of ideas that, you know, like we haven't even talked about class.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't even dealt with the goofs and the poverty and the higher ups and the low. I mean, literally the higher ups and the lower downs.
And I'm just going to throw out, again, just a quick shout out to Elsie. We don't have to talk about Elsie, but Elsie is a goof who is fascinating and very interesting, and you should read the comic and find out about Elsie.
Yeah.
And Elsie is responsible for Tekla's body. She's also responsible for Oix being revived. This is a character that contributes greatly to the comic and is also, I think, one of the more interesting. And at the end of the day, it is Elsie that influences and rescues Lisa, or Legia, who you referenced earlier as having a change of heart. And, you know, at the end of the comic, we have a setup for a buddy comedy.
Yes.
And whether that works out or not, I'm just...
Spoilers, those characters do go on to do new and interesting things as the story progresses.
But this is a character, talking about the class, you know, idea is... who's probably smarter and more interesting than 99% of the rest of the characters in the comic.
Yeah. Introduced very late in the comic as well. Yes. And again, it will go on as the story progresses, but a very fascinating character. That also brings up another aspect of this story is that there are, and again, we don't you don't think much about it now, but in 1991, there are many, many women characters in this story in positions of power, whether they're generals and captains and scientists and doctors.
Dr. Giordano.
Right. Yeah. Read the comic. But this is very forward thinking in many ways. You think this is just going to be a silly sci-fi pulp adventure. Flash Gordon type of thing. But there's
you can read it that way.
Yeah. There's some really interesting and progressive ideas in this. Could write a thesis on this.
I think one could.
Yes. You know, I guess to wrap up here, I think this is a very, very entertaining and worthwhile read. Seek it out. Seek out Magnus Robot Hunter, or Robot Fighter.
We were not expecting this. And I think this is what's great about just doing this. Even if two people are listening, is we both found something deeper and much more interesting in this comic.
Right. And I had a different appreciation of Jim Shooter after reading this, which is saying something.
I think we both recommend it.
Yeah, I definitely do. Yeah.
Well worth checking out. I never knew in my life I would say a comic book called Magnus Robot Fighter.
Exactly.
Is something that I enjoyed on multiple levels, but yet here we are.
Absolutely. I'm right there with you. Yeah.
Who knew?
Okay. Well, that's it for today's episode. What are we going to do next time, Mr. Brian?
Whew. I felt like I should have prepared a speech for this one, and I didn't. I think anybody listening to this will already be aware of the situation around one of the creators of this comic. And it's something we haven't addressed yet, which surprises me, but because of the timing of how these things go. I am recommending JLA Avengers, the early 2000 comic written by Kurt Busiek with the stunning, as always, art by maybe one of the greatest masters in comics, which is George Perez. And I realize this comes across as a bit timely. We've done George Perez before, but it just seems like the right time.
Yeah.
And particularly with a reissue that is coming, that should have been coming long before now. So it is with some trepidation that JLA Avengers, and it's a 4-issue limited series written by Kurt Busiek and illustrated by the mighty George Perez.
Yes. So this is something I'm looking forward to. It's it's just a fun comic to begin with, but yes, because of what's going on with George Perez. This one's good. And you know, and now we know that there's a reissue coming, which is going to be money. All the proceeds are given to charity. And there's some controversy around it as well, which we'll probably get into next week, but or when we actually do it. this is going to be fun. It's going to be fun to talk about. And
it's going to be a blast to talk about, which is exactly what it should be.
I think we should each take sides. So you be DC and I'll be Marvel.
Or we could really change things up.
Oh, you could be Marvel and I'll be DC.
I could be Marvel and you could be DC. We'll figure that out.
Yeah.
But we could just both
like it equally. There's that too.
But honoring a legacy is always a good thing.
Yeah.
So, okay. So that's next.
Yes. So I look forward to that.
You're crying.
No crying. There's no crying in comics. So before we go, a couple of minor things. I have done a little redesign to the website at collectededitionpodcast.com. Got a little slicker, changed out the logo, just a couple of things. So please go check that out and you can leave comments on individual episodes. Also, I have started a new little feature on the site where I am going to be, it's called New Number Ones. I'm going to pick a new release, number one comic every week and just give it a quick review. So, you know, just a little something extra to do there. Maybe Brian will do that too.
Maybe I will.
Okay. And another thing, if you don't mind, Brian, I have also relaunched my other podcast, The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast with new episodes coming out.
Nice.
Definitely every 2 weeks, and I'm going to try to do bonus episodes every other week. So, so I'm very excited to do that. So please go check that out if you can. I have a lot of fun doing it.
Don't we have a Daredevil Man Thing podcast?
Well, that's going to be coming up, an upcoming episode. I might have a special guest on to talk about Daredevil. Yeah. So please check all that out. And leave us your thoughts and opinions. We always want to know how you feel, and let us know what we got wrong and what we got right. Oh yeah, Twitter. Hit us up on Twitter. Collected EdPod. That's Collected EDPOD. And until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's Collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
I like that. There's a lot of things like I didn't get into. I wanted to mention Jim Shooter's new universe he did for Marvel, which everybody hated, but he used that as a basis for Valiant.
Right. Also gave us like Starbrand and who is still being used.
It also gave us Kickers, which was the football superheroes.
BP5 or something, which I think I liked. I bought a bunch of those when it came out.
Yeah. I think it was DP7, actually.
DP7,
which is a porn category, I believe. Okay, sorry.